Hey, what's going on, guys? Taxation is theft, and we are back live. Sorry, it's been a while. I was down in Crystal Beach, Texas, at the Canna Fest last weekend, and that was pretty fun. We got rained in, but that was still a pretty good time. So I want to introduce Reza. He's a libertarian activist that I've had the pleasure of hanging out with a few times. Well, let me first welcome Reza. How's it going?
Hey Dan, going good. How about you?
Pretty good. So, what this came about because John McCain passed, and then there was a lot of back and forth of mixed emotions from libertarians and others about John McCain, and this brought about some interesting issues about foreign policy. So Reza had the idea, hey, why don't we have like a foreign policy debate? So here we are.
Yeah, I thought it would be a good idea because, I was born in Iran, raised in Kuwait, studied in Canada, and moved to Texas. And what I've realized, at least in the US, there is really not much discussion in politics about foreign policy.
Right, it's forbidden.
It is. And even within our party as libertarians, I mean, we have really great points in our platform, but still, we don't discuss issues in detail. Now, given that we had the 2018 caucuses and the newborn of the Libertarian Party, I think it's good to have also between us different discussions on different issues.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's always good to talk about this stuff. I know it's, man, I don't know how many times I've been told, hey, it's not polite to talk about politics in public. But yeah, I mean, these really are things that we do need to talk about because the reality is we've got a shitty government, and it's shitty because nobody wants to talk about what it's doing, and we want to just, hide and pretend that it's not there, and maybe someone's just gonna come along, some knight in shining armor on a white horse is gonna come along and just fix everything for us, and it's all gonna be great. So we don't need to talk about it,
Yeah, and somehow that person is not going to get elected by our votes. So, I mean,
right?
that's the other part of it, waiting for.
So here's what we decided. We were like, okay, we could do another debate where like we've got like some boring guy in a suit who's gonna come up with questions, but we decided, hey, we're libertarians. We're gonna do the decentralized debate platform. So there's not gonna be a central authority who gets to determine the questions or how long we get to talk or anything like that. We're just gonna fight it out like real libertarians, and we'll just see how it goes. So, did you come up with a couple questions?
Well, my idea was the reason my heading was that I'm doing this to honor John McCain's life and his heroism in the army and afterwards in the Senate. Of course, we have different political perspectives with John McCain, and he has also changed throughout his life, especially over the past couple years on the issue of Iraq. So I thought to bring in more in this discussion, the perspective that they would have as opposed to what we have as libertarians, and try to open up the issues and go in more depth in a few aspects. One of them would be about the morality of our position in foreign policy. The other one would be the historical aspects, and the result of it would be our responsibility, where we are right now in history. And whether or not we're responsible, and how much of that responsibility is bear on our shoulders as American citizens. So these are the issues that I'd like to talk
Okay.
about from my end.
So let's first start out by saying, especially within the libertarian circles, it's very divided. So there's a lot of people on the left who were, they were cheering that John McCain died. The right was really sad that he died, and then the libertarians were kind of split. Some of them were saying, oh, well, he's an American, he's a soldier, a war hero. We should honor that, and we should, be crying over his death. And there were other people who were basically like laughing and saying, yeah, we're glad he's dead because he was this warmonger and he was dropping all these bombs and everything. I'm kind of myself, it sounds like you're kind of sympathetic to his life. I'm not so crazy on the left, like I'm celebrating, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, eh, whatever, he's gone. That's one less person fighting to drop bombs on foreign countries. So that's kind of my position. So, and there's a huge mix out there. So, and you know, I'm not here to tell anybody that they're wrong on, you know, crying over someone's death. Okay, fine. But yeah, I think a lot of the things that he did were criminal. And I even made one post where I said, look, were any of you crying when they killed Osama bin Laden? And I know they're not the same person, and Osama's arguably a much worse person. But there's that, you know, the same arguments for crying over McCain are, but he was a human being. He was a war hero. He was this and that. And to some people, Osama bin Laden was a war hero. He was a human being. He did have a life. It was a life that ended. And so there's a lot of those parallels. But of course, there's the patriotic. Oh, but he's an American. You know, he was held as a prisoner of war and all this other stuff.
Well, I think I'm to first distinguish my position. I mean, Osama bin Laden was the one of the most horrifying personalities in the 21st century, in my opinion, and also part of a good part of the 20th century. Being there from that part of the world, I mean, the guy was a religious fanatic who had the arms to do what he wanted and the network. So. But as far as John McCain, I think there's more depth into his position. There is in whether that individual or there is a group or in the Senate or Capitol Hill, because of the historical context of our foreign interventions and the historical endowments that the United States had, I think John McCain is an equilibrium. He's not necessarily a person with ambition to want to bomb countries. That's definitely not some perspective I had of him, having followed the Middle East and his positions in the Middle East. Now, should we divide a few minutes between us so I open up my perspective and then you follow up and then we do
Yeah,
vice
sure.
versa? Okay. So I think the United States going towards World War II had a very naive perspective on global issues as a whole country. And that's what led to a premature army to step in to one of the greatest technological advancement in the hand of a madman state, which at the time was Hitler's Nazi Germany. And as a result of that, without going too much into the details of the war, the US had a policeman of the world position. And then there was the different councils was put together by Europe and the US and other countries. The United Nations got formed in a more foreign policy mediator position, and we had NATO in power through the whole process. So when we go back to that history 60 years ago, 70 years ago, there's a lot of things that we have endowments of. And what I think ended up being the 1990s and the 2000s, and in this 2010 onwards of McCain's positions, is an answer to what was created 60 years ago. Because once you become the policeman of the world, now we can argue about whether or not that is something we should still continue to have or not, and there's better ways or not to have that. But as far as the historical context, I think that John McCain's position was in line with the US position, and as all citizens, we are also responsible to some extent. I mean, our tax dollars go to the government. The government uses those tax dollars to fund the Pentagon. The Pentagon makes all these policies, and whether or not backfire or not, we are, as taxpayers and American citizens, also responsible in that whole process. whether or not we agree with it. So, and not all of that is our government's fault. I mean, by no means a lot of these Middle Eastern religious states, such as Iran, for instance, or what was headed by Osama bin Laden and the Taliban in Afghanistan, or what is now kind of not necessarily in the government, but in the people within Pakistan, these are not safe zones. And in an international economy, not having safe zones is not good for trade, and it would get them to more extremism. So there's a lot of perspectives that I can talk about to defend his position on the perspective here. Now, don't get me wrong, the way I think the Iraq war was initiated was without any management. What we got from World War II, General Eisenhower and MacArthur, both in Germany and Japan, what they left with was a couple nations, nation states that are very prosperous, even more prosperous than we are right now in many aspects of civil liberties and more of a fair economy, I would say. So what we had in Iraq was really a childish game of picking where to go, where to bomb, and without asking why or how or what's the exit plan. That was from the beginning, it was a premature entry, which many of the politicians regretted it, including Bill Clinton, even though he wasn't really in any position of power, but he did support it maybe initially. And then at the very end of John McCain's life, he did regret a lot of things that happened in Iraq. He did come public with it. So it, to my understanding, that event, that today is 9/11, so all of these events happened, these modern events happened after 9/11, as a result of 9/11, some of them. But the execution of the plan, I think, was completely, there was no plan on execution from the United States. I mean, the U.S. had no historical background in the Middle East. They were learning as they go. Even Condoleezza Rice, I think in her book, she also wrote a lot of stuff that kind of presents the situation of the Oval Office not knowing what's happening, which group is what, and what are they doing, and what have they done in the past. So there was no educational background, the Bush administration, at least, that went into war. And I think a lot of the things that in execution of the war was done by Rumsfeld and the Bush administration, John McCain opposed it. So the methods they used, he wasn't really aligned with how they were doing it, the pace and the number of soldiers and the whole perspective. So that's part of my perspective, is
so
the execution.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as far as the execution and strategy, I completely agree with you on that. But I'd even go further and say, you know, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. And, you know, you made a couple good points about how, you know, these aren't safe places in the world. But that would get into the debate about whether or not the U.S. should be the world police, because, you know, yeah, these these places are not safe. And yeah, that does affect their trade. But the reality is, you know, if there's an unsafe place, who says you have to trade with that place? If that place is so unsafe that you're scared to go there and trade, don't go there and trade. That doesn't mean you have to go there and bomb them until they're safe enough that you can make a profit from them. That's, you know, that basically violates the non-aggression principle, saying, you know, I'm going to use force to force you to be good people until you're willing to trade with me the way that I want to trade. And in fact, the only argument that I would ever have for any type of foreign intervention would be that innocent people are being killed. But I would take the approach to that where, you know, so let's say you have Iraq, and let's say you have some evil dictators who are doing some evil things to harm their people. I would say, okay, look, this is wrong. This is an oppression. This is a violation of their rights. But at the same time, it's not right to say, okay, we're going to, over here in the U.S., we're going to steal billions, trillions of dollars from one group of people. We're going to use it to hire a bunch of mercenaries to go over there. And even if this is all, you know, get rid of the corruption and all the illegal stuff that they're doing on the side and stealing oil and all that stuff, they're just going there for one purpose, and that's to kill an evil dictator. That should not be done by stealing money from one group of people. It should be, if anything, it should be, you know, the funds for that should be raised the same way, you know, Greenpeace might save a whale or a tree or something and say, hey, there's an evil dictator over there. Let's, you know, who wants to volunteer to go fight him? Because the reality is, before the U.S. had income tax, they still had military, they still had Navy and all this other stuff. And a lot of that was volunteer. So, for example, what kind of military did we have to fight off the British? That wasn't even technically a military. It was just a bunch of volunteers saying, hey, we've got our guns, we're being invaded, we're going to defend ourselves. Now, of course, you know, if we're talking about some evil tyrant in Iraq, we're not defending ourselves, but we see somebody who needs to be defended. So we might step up and say, hey, we're going to go over there and we're going to help them defend themselves. For one thing, you don't draft people and force them to participate in wars that they don't want to participate in. You don't steal money from people and force them to defend people that they don't want to defend. Yes, I understand that, you know, there's a whole sympathetic empathy experience to say these people need to be defended, but still, stealing is wrong. And we can't set an example to say, oh, it's for a good thing, we're going to steal, because the next thing you know, everyone's stealing to build roads because, oh, it's a good thing for everybody. And you end up with this, you know, this, you're setting a bad example basically for the next generation, the next program that goes on. So, you know, I don't think it's bad to go around the world to defend people, but I think it is bad in the way that the U.S. government does it. And then especially when you pile on top of it all these things you mentioned about not having a plan, not having a specific enemy that you can say, you know, once we destroy this enemy, it's over, it's done. You know, there's all that. But then, of course, you also have the, you know, I mean, this goes deeper into the whole history of it, of, you know, how the U.S. has been arming and funding terrorists in the Middle East for what, 70 or 80 years now. So they've kind of created a lot of their own problems in that way, that, you know, now they're saying, oh, we've got to go make things worse by arming and training another resistance who's going to fight the first one that we created. And then 10 years from now, we're probably going to have to arm and fund somebody else to take down that one.
Well, I wouldn't say, I do understand the resistance that the United States had in the Cold War against the Soviet Union by funding militants in Afghanistan. But I don't think it goes back 70 years. I think what you're thinking about might be the 1953 overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. Am I right? You were talking about that incident?
I think so. Well, so... I mean, so you're talking about Soviets. Let me ask you this. What's the earliest incident that you can think of where the U.S. funded any type of resistance group in the Middle East?
I know the British were much more involved in the 19th century and the early 20th century, but the U.S. Really got involved in the Middle East, I think, during the 1920s or 30s in Iran, in the oil industry.
That's closer to 90 years.
But that's not as a hostile agent, more as a trade partner, would argue.
Fair enough. What about the Shah? When was that? That was like...
The Shah was in power, I think, from 1940... something to 1979.
So 79, that would be 80. So that would be close to 40 years. Okay, so even if we let's just say that's the milestone, right? So let's say we've been tampering with that part of the world for like 40 years now.
There's a couple perspective on if you go back to that part of history. During the time that the latest Shah of Iran was in power, there was an incident in 1952-53 that his prime minister, Mossadegh, illegally took over the power of the country. And then the question was, and Iran has been a stabilizer in the region prior to the Islamic Republic being in that area. The question the CIA asked, and these were more social scientists at the CIA. I forgot their names, but there were a couple of them that studied the situation, and they realized just with a... And there's a fallacy within the libertarian some of the libertarian groups that they think the U.S. spent a whole lot of money and a whole lot of stuff to overthrow Mossadegh. It's false. It was just a few million dollars, I think shy of $5 million at the time, that they spent mostly on intelligence to help the Shah gain power and stability back in Iran. And that was, I think, I'm not very educated in the whole history of the CIA and how many involvements they had in so many hundreds of countries, but that was one of the things I think both the Iranian people and the Americans are thankful for, that involvement, because Mossadegh was more of a communist-oriented person who illegally overthrew the head of the state and the take back of the power was not really a incident that caused a lot of casualties or a big scene in the region. It was more of a very quick turnaround of event. It took a few weeks, and then the country went back into stability. And then we had in Iran there were about 10 years worth of economic revolution that followed. So I think the one of the, I guess, involvement that the U.S. had in the region that started the whole mess was funding of the insurgents in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, which happened later on. And that was a situation that, I mean, it was at the, I think the same time as Vietnam was happening. It was like the whole global capitalist system against the whole communist system. And a lot of these movements that happened both in Eastern Europe and in Asia or in the Middle East, because the spread was so large, not everything went back to normal or repair mode. And Afghanistan was one of those places that once it was done, no one cared about, okay, what's going to happen next? Obviously, the Afghans were not put back into, I mean, in the time the Shah was in power in Iran, Afghanistan was a modern state, if you believe it or not. I mean, all of these Burkas and these Islamic crazy insurgents who want everyone to be sitting at home, no one studying, if you're a woman, that is. They did not really have power in Afghanistan in the 50s or 60s, I think. So the whole Middle East exploded when basically Jimmy Carter refused to intervene in Iran in 1979, because Carter's position on foreign policy was very premature in picking the battles to fight and battles not to fight. So he basically became indifferent in Iran. And the idea was that, well, our biggest enemy is the Soviet Union. And this was, I'm talking about the 1970s here. So this is a couple of decades before the crash of the Soviet Union. So when it came to Iran, they said, well, we're looking at Khomeini here, and Khomeini is an Islamist, and the Soviets are agnostic or atheists. So naturally, the Islamists are not going to like the Soviets. And that was, to some extent, a true statement. But what they miscalculated was if they let Iran to fall into the Islamist hand, what backlash it would have on the whole region. And I think the whole other wars that happened, the first Persian Gulf War between Iran and Iraq that took 8 years, I was actually born at the end of it in Tehran. And then the Kuwait-Iraq War, and then we had the U.S.-Iraq War, and now we have Syria. This is all as a result of instability by a regime in Iran at the time, was the Shah, who actually had control over the whole region. So the what's talked about, and even Ron Paul talks about something that I think is a fallacy. He said the reason the Iranian uprose against the Shah, and we have the Islamic Republic in place now, is because the U.S. and Europe were involved in overthrowing Mossadegh, but that's false. I think these two events are completely irrelevant. If anything, the Shah was more civil in not going after and killing the opposition. The extent of what he did was put people in exile. Was his approach in the Middle East, and I think the fact that Carter didn't get involved in Iran, and then obviously a year after the revolution, we had Ronald Reagan in power in the U.S., which had an opposite foreign policy than Carter had. And then we had Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom, who had also a much opposite policy than the previous administration had. So it was one of those historical events where the world was in their own misery. So we had a lot of things that in the time of Jimmy Carter happened, a lot of government institutions really that grew in Carter's time, including the Department of Education, Department of Urban and Housing Development. And then in the UK, they had the unions in the 70s. And Wales had their unions on coal, which both of these countries were heavily involved in the Middle East. Both the United Kingdom and the US were involved in the Middle East. And because of their own internal problems, foreign policy was not really a topic of the day, kind of like what we have today in the US. I mean, foreign policy is not really widely discussed in any of our news media organizations, or even by, I mean, whatever we see over the past couple of years from President Trump's perspective is more talks about something that's really not practical in case of Middle East or the Korean Peninsula. So I think a lot of our problems that we are paying for right now, and a lot of our national debt goes back to that incident where Iran had its really, it was a kind of a monarchy democracy that got collapsed. And the aftermath of that was obviously once you have a region that's unstable and economic prosperity is at the lowest for a good period of time, then you see all these Islamists taking advantage of the victims of the wars, those orphans and children, and start brainwashing them in their whole schooling system. And this is not just Iran, I'm talking about Iraq, I'm talking about to some extent Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Afghanistan, Pakistan, even Saudi Arabia to an extent, and a few of the Middle Eastern, the Persian Gulf countries. So once you empower more, I mean, if someone is economically unprivileged, they're more open to radical ideas because they have nothing to lose. And that's something that the Islamists, extremists really in that region, have been banking on. And Russia, even after the Soviet Union collapse, under Putin, has been heavily involved in the region by annexing different areas. But one of the areas that has not been talked about was after an agreement between Iran, at the time Persia, and the former, this wasn't even the Soviet Union, this was the Tsar's time. I think it was called the Turkmenchai Agreement Treaty, or another treaty. The name might be false. Iran had control over 50% of the Caspian Sea, as opposed to at the time 100%, because they lost a few territories up north. But under Putin, what happened was they took another 37% of the Caspian Sea from Iran, because Iran was basically in economic power and in all sort of alliance power, felt to be more on the side of the Chinese and the Russians than on the West. And that caused Iran to lose 37% of the Caspian Sea, which is an oil and mineral-rich ocean. Not ocean, I'm sorry, a closed sea, but it's pretty large. So they talk about Crimea, they talk about other stuff, but just not about 10, 15 years ago, that was what Russia took from Iran. And of course, Iran agreed to it. It wasn't a hostile takeover of the sea, but this is something that is happening and it's real. And as it grows, it will eventually become a problem for the United States and the West. Just to give you an example, as a result, now I don't want to get into, and we might not have time to get into it, both of us, to see what was the cause of Syria and who helped fund Syria and what conspiracy theory is true and what's not. Obviously, it's a mess. It's such a mess that there was no leadership in fixing it with any administration, whether it was the end of the Bush administration or the whole Obama administration or the Trump administration. There is no solution to Syria that I've heard about. It's actually a solution. But what happens when you have these kinds of events And you have similar events going in Yemen right now, that insurgents are fighting, and we have thousands of people getting killed every day that no one hears about in the US with our bombs and our drones, and even with their bombs and their drones made in Russia or made in the US or Europe, that you see refugees coming. So once you have the refugees coming, the first place they're going to is Europe, naturally. I mean, you're a refugee. What are you going to do? Your whole country has been collapsed by both domestic and foreign intervention. And then you go to Europe, and then there's a clash of civilizations and culture. So then it becomes a burden to our trading allies that we trade with, which makes the whole public, it puts another, it's kind of an additional tax initially, because if a population is going to take care of another, even if it's 1 million people, as even if it's 1% of their own population over a period of small amount of time, it's still kind of taxes on the people. So there is a burden both culturally and financially on Europe to take care of the Syrians who should have otherwise lived in their own country in prosperity had the foreign had the United Nations, NATO, and foreign powers had a better play in the region. So you're right. Yes, we should. Why should you and I, through our taxes, whether it's income tax, I mean, we pay what, 50% of our money goes to taxes one way or another, sales tax, state tax, property tax, and a lot of it is an indirect, so we don't see it on paper, but prices goes up because of taxes. So why do we pay for it? There's a few things I think it's important. One is we're kind of responsible on the foreign policy side. I'm not talking about the roads and all the other stuff that government is inefficient at. But at least on the foreign policy side, which is mismanaged, by the way, which even our both governors who ran for president, Bill Weld and Gary Johnson, said we can at least cut 10% of it without even anyone hearing about it being cut. So the wasteful spending is so high, we're spending at wartime budgetary allocations. When, who are we with war with?
Yeah, it's
So.
something like 10 times now than it was pre-9/11, and even now that Osama's been killed and the war on terror should have been over, we're still spending 10 times what we were in 2001 or 2000.
Yeah. But the part of responsibility that I want to kind of let you and our party side understand a bit more is if we're citizens of this country and our parents or grandparents have been somehow, whether it was brought upon them like Hitler was, or whether it was a mistake, a calculated mistake, or an intentional mistake like Vietnam would have been, that we have intervened in other countries. At the end of the day, we are to some extent responsible to two groups of people, really. One is all those veterans that got amputated, suffering from PTSDs, or who got killed in all of these events in the name of the United States Constitution and saving the world and liberating the world to a US standard, which is basically freedom is what they preach. But to us and to the veterans, that means real freedom. People can choose to live and pray and do whatever they want as long as they don't harm others. So that's one thing that we would leave behind if we get out of a lot of these countries. The second thing is to the population, especially children. Now, on adults, we can discuss different perspectives on, but if our tax dollars and our government, whom we are a citizen of, and I'm a volunteer citizen of the United States because I immigrated here, if we are somehow generationally responsible for their suffering, that means that we have to bring it back at least to where they were before our interventions in those regions. And if we don't do it, that's, to my perspective, and I'm sure that not everyone agrees with me, especially in our party, I think that's something that as a nation, as a state, we are responsible for.
Well, I think, okay, so to the point of responsibility, yes, some people did some damage, but there's the question of we, who is we? I didn't voluntarily, like, I was robbed. I'm a victim of being robbed and by these criminals, and these criminals, not only did they just rob me, they went and destroyed a lot of people's lives on the other side of the country. So, as you talk about responsibility, that's not necessarily my responsibility because I didn't do the actual damage. But at the same point, there is, you know, I mean, you can, everyone's definition of words is different. So responsibility, if you're responsible for something that's, you know, your fault, right? It's not my fault that this happened. At the same time, I do have an ability to somehow help, you know, the other side of the world. So, for example, you see a homeless person. It's not your fault. It's not your responsibility that they are homeless, but you have money in your pocket. You can give them something. You can buy them a meal. You can help them out because you're able to. You're charitable. You're able to do so voluntarily. So I think there, you know, there is a lot of that. What I see a lot of is, you know, so many, you know, we have these, all of these responsibilities. We need to take care of all the elderly who are on Social Security. We need to take care of all the vets who came back. Now, I don't want to say, you know, because a lot of people look at the libertarians and they say, oh, you hate poor people, you hate vets, you hate old people, because you want to kill all these programs and you're trying to say it's not your responsibility to take care of them. My perspective is that it's not our responsibility that they're in the shitty position that they're in, but that we do have, you know, I hate using the word responsibility because that kind of gets, you know, that there's a mixed feeling of what that actually means as to whether it's someone's fault or someone's able to help. But I see it as this, like, yes, we should be doing things to help these people. We shouldn't be claiming responsibility by saying it's your fault and therefore you have an obligation. We should be figuring out a way to do it voluntarily, because the reality is, and especially, like, you know, what I've seen in my life in the Middle East is, you know, so we start out with a shitty position. Because, you know, it's the same thing with Israel versus Palestine. You go back far enough, they've been at, you know, everyone's like, oh, they've been at war for 2,000 years and it's never going to stop. But you go back far enough, somebody threw the first rock, but it's so far in the past, you're never going to figure out who threw the first rock. At this point, what we have to do is we have to say, okay, look, one of us has to be the bigger person who's going to stop throwing rocks, and we have to stop the cycle. And, you know, that might mean that one person's going to stop throwing rocks and the other person's not going to come to that conclusion yet, so they're still going to be throwing rocks at you, but you've got to just say, hey, you know what, that hurts, but I'm going to let that happen, because if I keep throwing rocks back, I'm going to continue the cycle, and they have no reason to stop because they're going to say, oh, but you just threw one at me. And so I think, you know, when it comes to, you know, do we have a responsibility to fix the problems that are there? I think, you know, I acknowledge that there are problems and people need help and these problems need to be solved. But I think anything that involves, you know, we're going to continue stealing from people to fund a massive empire military organization who's going to travel around the world and say, okay, well, we sat in a room a million miles away, a few thousand miles away. We sat in a room and we took the information that we knew, which isn't really a whole lot because we're not over there. We don't know everything. But we took what limited information we do have, and we're going to decide how we're going to fix their problem without even talking to them. And we're just going to go over there with our drones and our bombs and our tanks and our military, and we're going to make it happen. And I think what that does is that, you know, even if it's the most well-intentioned thing, it's the problem where it's Americans deciding what's best for another group of people. And these other group of people might not agree with that. They might be sold on it in some cases. They might say, oh, well, you know, yeah, the Americans are going to come here and they're going to do something. And they might say, hey, that sounds like a great idea. And they might buy it and then later find out, hey, that was a shitty idea. Maybe they're resentful over it, and hey, you did that on purpose. You tricked us into this, and now they hate us, and now they're fighting back against us. It can go a million ways, but I think if instead of saying we're going to do this by force, like even if we just went over there and said, hey, look, we're not going to force you to do anything, but these are all the people from the U.S. who have volunteered to help you in whatever way needed. If you want help, if you want this to happen, you decide how you want to fix your region, and we will help you in that. And I don't think anyone's ever taken that approach. They've always just said, no, we're going to decide and we're going to force you to do it this way.
Well, the difference, I mean, looking historically, the countries that we actually helped as the United States, and they're prosperous now, take Japan, for instance. When MacArthur was in Japan for a few years, the U.S. actually controlled the government. So the transition from a military government to a civilian government took a few years, and it was very well planned. I mean, there were coordinations between MacArthur and U.S. presidents and politicians back home with FDR, and really scientists who look at it with deep thought. What we had in Iraq, for instance, I remember being a kid when the U.S. actually invaded Iraq. I was in Kuwait, and the real victory happened in 5 minutes. I mean, what the American people didn't see in the U.S. that I saw in Kuwait was footages of thousands of tanks, and within seconds, they're all gone. So the might of the U.S. military is beyond imagination. And that was not the secret weapons they had. So to a very good extent, you're right. I mean, our war technology is not the solution to this problem, because we have things that are probably seen in movies right now. I mean, when Saddam was hitting the Kuwait, for instance, with missiles, these missiles, before they were even launched, were detonated by U.S. missiles. Called the Patriot system. At the time, they said they have 7 Patriot levels, and in Kuwait they brought the 3rd one in. That's good against chemical warhead. So what, to my mind, was like, what was the 4th, 5th, 6th, or 7th, and all the secret anti-missile system that the U.S. has. So yes, but the problem the Bush administration had, that Bush Jr., Bush Sr. understood the Middle East very well. That's why he did not get, once the first Persian Gulf War happened and the second one, he didn't intervene in Iraq, because he knew what a mess the United States would inherit if they do so. So it was more of a tactical approach that Bush Sr. did in the Middle East. Yes, they liberated Kuwait, they liberated the anti-Iraq regions at the time. I mean, those people who were for Iraq in the first war were anti-Iraq afterwards. Then the U.S. planted military bases in the Middle East, but didn't actually use it. So those military bases were there, and we exported, I mean, at the time it wasn't we, but I mean, the United States exported its trade mechanisms in all those countries. That's why you see Kuwait is a very prosperous nation, economically speaking. You see the United Arab Emirates is very successful, Qatar is successful, Oman, Saudi Arabia, despite all the civil problems compared to our civilization that their civilization have, mostly towards the LGBT community and the women population and freedom of speech and thought. I mean, they're behind all of those categories. Yet the country is stable as far as financial is concerned. So what Bush Sr. planted in the area with their foreign policy and Clinton followed was more of our libertarian way of let's expand diplomacy and trade. And what Bush Jr. failed to do is, without calculating what to do, they just went in Iraq, collapsed the whole system, and without knowing which group is what group, there's something I think in Condoleezza's book about they dismantled the Iraqi National Guard, which was supposed to be trained to transfer to the new government. So they just dismantled the whole army, and then obviously, once you don't have order in place, then all these extremists are able to grow out of it. And so most of the things that the U.S. did in the Iraq war were really, yeah, all the weapons were tested, deployed. I mean, one of them wasn't tested. I remember seeing there's a low-grade uranium enrichment that if they find these chemical facilities, they're going to throw on it. And for a few miles, it's going to completely melt everything, but it's not nuclear. So it's not going to have all the side effects of nuclear. Mm-hmm. But they had that in ready to use from Kuwait to launch it into Iraq. And that never got used. And later on, we found out there was no weapons of mass destruction that really right. They were talking about. Some hope. But I mean,
And
it's really.
that's kind of, back to my point about, we don't know what's going on. Like, there's so much bad intel. Even, I mean, as we're sitting here having this discussion, we can talk about the history of what's happened there. But the reality is, like, in our own cities, what happened in the last election in whatever city you might be in, something shady might have gone on behind the curtains there that nobody knows about. And when we're talking about places that are thousands of miles away, when we're talking about stuff that happens, with we get most of our information from sources in the White House and the Pentagon. I mean, you're talking about Condoleezza. Most of the information that comes at
So
us
these
on
are con
TV.
confessions of Condoleezza right now. So
Right,
this was,
but what I'm saying is, do you think she's telling us everything? Is she hiding a couple things that, like, maybe, she's still under contract that she can't talk about because they're
well,
classified and she'd go to prison?
I think what she exposed is really a red alert on the whole state of our foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. It's a big red. If you're dismantling your whole army in a country and then not knowing why you're doing it and what without calculating the
Absolutely,
after, that's nuts.
but does she not know why they were doing it? Could there have been somebody else? I mean, because this is, this is my perspective on, like, Bush Jr. He's not, some people have said he is kind of a genius, but in my opinion, he's not the brightest pencil in the box. And so how, like, the way I see it, we've got the Pentagon, who loves doing all kinds of, like, crazy shit. There's something like, 10,000 drone strikes that go off per month. And I can't see Bush sitting around there saying, okay, look, here's 10,000 places on a map. This is where we're going to go bomb. Like, the way, how much of this just comes from, like, the Pentagon is like, oh, we need to do this. We need to do this. And so, they go and they report to the president, they
Well,
report to Condoleezza.
so here's what's missing on U.S. foreign policy after Bill Clinton. Because in Bill Clinton's time, I remember Bill Clinton striked, well, there was a Bosnia-Herzegovina war happening in Europe that was really well managed, in my opinion, as far as management goes. Now, forget about all the people that got killed and all the atrocities that a war brings on anyone. But and then there were a few strikes on Iraq. So in Clinton's time, what he accomplished against Iraq was there were I remember two I was in school. I remember in Kuwait that we hear the sirens go off because the U.S. is striking Iraq, and the United States striked Iraq in their key chemical weapon facilities and other military bases in the 1990, I think eight was the time. And then Saddam surrendered, and this was the basis that, yeah, he surrendered his weapon to the United Nations. They knew he surrendered the weapons, so he was a weak spot. Which Bush Jr. thought, he said, okay, this guy's now weak, and he's a dictator, and obviously, I mean, to just give you just a snapshot of who Saddam was in the Iran-Iraq war, he personally goes to facilities with Iranian, I guess, war captures. Or war heroes from the Iranian perspective. And he asks the people who are in charge of that, and these are, what do they call it, prisoners of war. So there's a whole United Nations and whole international treaties on how you're supposed to treat them. And he blows them up. And there are videos on this. I mean, you might even still be able to find on YouTube. And there are videos of him with a gun to prisoners of warheads. So by no means, and this is just to tell you a bit brief, Saddam was a point of stabilization compared to before him. Before Saddam, that region had a king every week. The joke in Iran was, from what my parents described to me and my grandparents, whenever someone went to the toilet and came out, they were asking, has the Iraqi government changed since I was gone? So this is what it was, and then it became Saddam. And obviously, he wasn't a kind soul. Neither was Hitler or any of the other, some of those dictators in Iran right now are not that far off from Saddam. But what Bush Jr. saw was like, okay, it's time to hit Iraq. Yes, and we had it in our master plan that Iraq needs to have Saddam gone. but it was uncalculated. It was a crime. I think it was criminal. That whole action was criminal. But going back to the main point, since Bill Clinton, there was really no leadership by the United States, even though we have astronomical budgets on military spending. I mean, taking it back to Bill Clinton's time would be a libertarian miracle if we can cut the budget back there, which we should. I think there's no reason we shouldn't. But because of lack of leadership by both the United States and by leaders in the United States, whether it's senators or congressmen, there is no, the Middle East does not have any other solution than military solution, because no one is taking any. It's kind of like whenever you need money, you ask the Fed to print it. So that's not our problem. They designated the employment mandate to the Federal Reserve. Okay, you guys go fix the employment problems, and we're just gonna be here writing off checks and favors here and there. And same thing happened with Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, especially after World War II. No thanks to Eisenhower just telling us about it. He didn't do much to prevent it. He wasn't really a politician to prevent the military-industrial complex to become so large. So Congress just says, okay, Pentagon and complex, you guys go fix that problem. Even though, as you described, these problems are really, if we spend, as Bill Clinton said in 2006 in a Montreal summit, I was there, he said, had we spent the amount of equivalent to one F-18, I think he said, on education in Pakistan, we might not have the Osama bin Laden problem. So obviously, our foreign, if our military budget was spent partly on foreign educational and all those interventions to build markets and trade partners, then we wouldn't have this Yemen problem or the Syria problem or the Iraq problem. These are really decisions that should have not been made. And part of that is because of the incompetency of Congress. Congress is incompetent when it comes to foreign affairs. I mean, they're really illiterate when it comes to it. So it's a big problem. But I think the fact that we and I are having this discussion, and we should have this more in the whole Libertarian Party, because hopefully we're the one who are going to replace the Republican Party not too long from now, thanks to Donald Trump. And these are things that we need to have a discussion on and see what's the path towards that end goal of completely voluntarism. Because there has to be a path. If tomorrow we come out and say with a magic wand, no more foreign intervention in the Middle East, what's going to happen next? Are we going to go there and build walls around all these countries? Or are we going to say, okay, all of you guys who are the victims of our foreign intervention and your religious fanaticism, you guys come in our countries. Obviously, if that was a solution, then a few billion people in the world would have just migrated to the West and problem solved. So that's the thing that we are going to inherit. And it's a very hard topic because, first of all, as libertarians, we really don't have access to a lot of information that you just asked about. Is this everything that was talked about? What are the unknowns that they know and the public doesn't know, or minor parties or even major party members don't know, who are active in politics? Obviously, it's too big of a problem that it's like too big to fail systems. So too big to spread information.
Yeah.
Kind of. So, but I think that our party should have discussions on these issues in detail, because if we're going to end militarism in the Middle East, for one, forget about Africa and all the other part of the world that have problems, then we have to have an exit strategy. Not just, okay, tomorrow morning we're just pulling off our troops. Even Bill Weld came out and said the other day in Florida that, what was it? Did he say 70,000 members of the military in Afghanistan that we have to pull out? To me, being from that part of the world, is that, okay, so what's the solution? Are we just pulling them out and say, okay, mission failed? And what's the blowback from doing that?
Well, obviously, I
don't know.
So there's, you know, I guess the Ron Paul libertarians would say, yes, just bring them home. And I think, you know, so there's one argument that says if you do pull them out immediately, then it's going to be like, you know, just going to Detroit and saying, get rid of all the police, and you have all these criminals there, and mayhem's going to break out. The reality is that if you look at a place where you have a lot of criminal activity and it's only being suppressed because you have a major police force there, like the US military, their presence there is not, if people are afraid to commit a crime because they think they're going to get shot doing it, does that really make them less of a criminal, or does that just make them, oh, they're still a criminal, they're just waiting for the right moment? And so, does that mean, okay, yes, if you pull the troops out, are crimes going to happen? That may be, but by keeping them there, are they reducing the number of these criminals who are there, or are they increasing the number? So let's say, for example, let's say you have a city of 1 million people, and let's just say, half of those people, 500,000 people are, terrorists ready to go out and kill and do all kinds of crazy things. Let's say they're not doing that stuff because the US military is there. But because the US military is there also, today you have 500,000, tomorrow you have 510,000, the next day you have 520,000. The number of criminals is increasing even though they're not actually doing any crimes because the military is there. Whereas let's say maybe if you pull the military out, that number starts to drop from 500,000 to 490 to 480. It's kind of like, the old question of, do you throw the switch on the railroad track where it kills one person over here or it kills 20 people over here? We don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. But the reality is, if, you've got basically one crime going on, and if you continue that crime, then some other crime won't happen, but the number of criminals is going to grow. So eventually, when let's say it just gets to some point where we just can't afford to have the military there and we have to bring them home, and there's absolutely no question about it, because they're not getting paid and they're pissed off and they're just like, well, hey, screw it, we're going home, we're not getting paid, there's no money. Then now you have the same problem, but you have more of the problem that's going to be there once you pull out. So, it's the old
It's
kick in the
a
can.
multi-dimensional problem.
Yeah, it is very complicated. And my gut always says, look, if there's a crime taking place, even though that crime is going to prevent another crime from happening, you have to stop that crime because one, you're going to make the number of crimes that happen worse once you do finally stop your crime, and you're teaching people that it's okay to act criminally. You're teaching people, I mean, and think about it. Like, if you live in a place that's, the military comes in and people with guns are just basically walking around pointing guns at people, telling them how you have to live your life, and then eventually those people leave, what have the people learned from that experience? They've learned, oh, you just need to get a bunch of people together, throw on some camouflage and walk around with guns and order people around and tell them how to behave. And so now you're teaching people this instead of teaching them, hey, don't treat people like that. And so, like you said about, spending the money of one F-18 on education would have changed a lot more things. If we were to change that focus in that direction, voluntarily funded, of course, to say, let's stop sending guns, start sending education, start sending volunteers. I think that's the real way to change. And yes, pulling out might cause some temporary problems, but I think in the long run, that's the only way we're going to get
But
to a peaceful solution.
so two problems here. One, in war, when you have two states fighting, obviously both sides want to end the war as soon as possible with more success. The more you drag a state into war, the more the state becomes fragile. In the case of the Middle East, in many of those states, once the US removed the state from power, or in that municipality or that region now in Syria, the only group that wants to prolong war is the Islamist extremists in those areas. Because in the time of Iran-Iraq war, for instance, the head of government in Iran, which was Khomeini, he thought of, and this is public speech, he thought of war as a blessing. The longer you can fight, the more people are going to come towards the ideology. And the same thought frame is now present in Syria, in Iraq, and to a large extent in Pakistan.
I would argue also in the U.S.
And
I mean, it's the endless war on terror. There's, you know.
A lot of people now in the U.S., everyone's with coats and ties and checks.
Yeah, it brings about this great patriotism. I don't think as many
and
Americans.
Industries and weapons and
exactly,
Lockheed Martin
exactly.
stuff keeps going up. Yeah. But the other problem, which is something that the solution that you're presenting, which I think eventually would become a solution, is the influence of primarily two states in the region. One of them is Russia, who is actively funding instability in the region. And the second one, which is more important, is Iran, that is actively funding instability of the region since the 1980s. So when you have two states spending their national budgets, mostly Iran in this case, on terrorism and instability in the region, in order that in the long term you would have this beautiful Islamic state governed by Iran, which is kind of what happened after Saddam was, as even Gary Johnson points out in 2009 in one of his interviews, or 2010, he said, well, we removed Saddam from power, now Iran is taking over Iraq, which was absolutely true. So you remove one person, at least at the time you had two states, there was a border there as far as religion and government. Now Iran has its hand, even in many instances, Iran is fighting with the U.S. military in Syria against these. So these insurgents are so crazy that the United States, Europe, and Iran are doing joint military ops against them. So, but the problem is, if we go, and by the way, probably you and I, if we're elected into government and we have these positions to get things done, it's not going to happen overnight anyways. I mean, obviously, as our platform suggests, the end goal is absolute non-aggression principle. But in the interim, to get to that point, I think as long as you have Iran and Russia with so much influence in the region to destabilize, it's going to make this task much more difficult. And I don't know what the solution is. I think this is something that should be brought into national debates on what's happening there. People need to know, because voters are not choosing or voting based on perfect knowledge,
right?
Outside. Even us libertarians don't know exactly what's happening. I mean, we want to get there, but how do we get there? That's the question. Obviously,
exactly, because all of our information is filtered through people who have been known to lie to us and manipulate us.
And who don't know what they're doing anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Donald Trump knows anything about the current state of foreign policy in the Middle East. I don't think he actually understands the history of the region. Now, obviously, there are generals in his administration, Kelly and Mattis, who know the region very, very well, and who probably are doing more than he is, but we don't really have a leadership to put these to an end. There's no Ronald Reagan telling the Soviets bring the wall down.
Right.
There is
yeah,
no.
I mean, I would argue, you know, if you said let's look at the past three presidents at least, not a single one of them like says, you know, let's. This is what the end looks like. This is the goal that we're reaching for. It's always just, oh, what are we going to do today? Oh, we're going to drop some more bombs. They don't have that fundamental, okay, this is at least the goal that we're going to get to. And I think that goes back to, you know, the perpetual war thing. You know, the war on terrorism was never designed, like terrorism is never going to go away. So the war never goes away. So the war is perpetual.
No, the war on terrorism was actually, there are historical documents and even videos of the Shah of Iran in the 1960s and 70s talking about the war against terror, which he was fighting efficiently back then in the region by building markets. And even it was talked as how many years has it been? 60 years, 50, 60 years ago, it was talked about. But the new war on terrorism that George Bush talks about, it was more rhetoric than
Right.
actually end goal action in mind. They said, okay, we just removed this guy from power, all roses are gonna
Yeah,
come
and I
out of.
mean the war on drugs is another perfect example where you've got it's an endless war. It's never like what's the end goal? You're gonna completely make a plant go extinct. From like that's kind of the idea behind it. If you're ever gonna win the war on drugs, the drug is gonna be completely annihilated. And at the same time, even during that, you've got people in the U.S. government actively supporting the trafficking of those same drugs that they're trying to end, supposedly. And I think there's a lot of this, there's like. So, some people will say, "Oh yeah, it's all this like grand orchestrated conspiracy." And I think, to some extent, yeah, there are people who are doing some crazy things and they're orchestrating things like in insane ways, but at the same time, I think a lot of it's just, you've got a lot of crazy people, you're giving them a crazy amount of money and a crazy amount of power, and they're all in it for different reasons. And so, when they all come together for the same, it's kind of like the same drive, the same greedy passion that they have where, I want money and power and I don't care who I kill to get it. They might not all be working together under the same plan, but they all kind of move towards that same result, which is more bombs, more guns, bigger armies, bigger budgets, and everything else.
Yeah, and 17 years ago, there was 9/11, and people, the public, was more for it because they saw something in homeland that happens pretty much every day in the Middle East. And the social, the vote was for war. So George Bush, with little accountability in the US, had unlimited amount of power to do whatever he wanted to do.
Right.
And to whatever extent he wanted to do. And I think he did too much too fast, as opposed to what could have been done as a result of us being attacked. But and that's part of it. That's part of the voting population does not understand the
Right. How much?
multidimensional problems of all of the things we're involved with. And they're voting anyways.
Right. And
People
how
are
much
voting
information
without
did we
knowing.
have on that whole thing? I mean, within a week after 9/11, or by the same day, I believe they were already saying it's bin Laden and all this other stuff. And of course, that actually turned out to be false. It was the Saudis who funded the whole thing, and we didn't find that out for like another 10 years or whatever. We're people just they start reacting. It's all over the news, and people are manipulated. And I think, yeah, and a lot of people, I might be on the fence about it. A lot of people feel that, that 9/11 was planned because they already had a plan to go into Afghanistan and Iraq and everything, immediately after that. And a lot of people see that there's oil and everything, so some people really feel manipulated by the whole thing. Meanwhile, at the same time, you have people that are just like blindly supporting it, who know absolutely nothing about any of it. They're just saying, "Oh yeah, go America because we're waving the flag."
But back to John McCain and the aftermath of the Second World War, I think the United States has had plans for all those players internationally that could turn out to become a Hitler. And in many instances, I mean, Saddam was a regional Hitler. Not only to his people, but to neighboring countries. And in other more sophisticated way, the Islamic Republic of Iran plays the same role as that. So I am not surprised, even Gaddafi was not such a peaceful soul. So the US has had plans, I think, rationally thinking about it, as an aftermath of Hitler and wanting to prevent anything like that from happening. It's kind of like if you had a time machine, would you go back and kill Hitler and
Right.
then see how things would change? So having that in mind, obviously, I think Pentagon has solutions for a lot of countries. for that. But I don't think the leadership who was endowed with all this information did it in a way that was practical. I mean, there are a lot of generals, like General Clark was one of them, who came out publicly later on and said, I went to the Pentagon and then I'm talking to my generals who used to be under me, and they're like, we're going to this country and then it's going to be the other one and the other one and the other one. It's like, kind of like, imagine if libertarians get elected one day and then we're like, we're just dissolving this institution tonight, and that one is going to follow next week, and that one's going to happen next week. Obviously, it was George Bush was like that. Okay, I know what my dad had in mind, so I'm gonna, now we have a disaster happening to us. Obviously, we have to strike back in Afghanistan because of the source was from there, given intelligence. But then it was like, okay, we have some intel from Iraq that there are these here, so might as well take a political wind and go and finish the job. Now, obviously, to him, finishing the job, and actually to historians, the job are two different things. I mean, I remember the British in Kuwait, because I was going to a British school there, and there were a lot of British generals who had kids in the school, and these things were more debated in the European community. And they were saying, well, when we go to war with Iraq, we're not going to go behind Basra, because to our intelligence and to our historical record, that's an area we can control and have safety and order. Beyond that point, we don't know what's going to happen. So let the Americans go do that. So obviously, George Bush, with his plan, grandiose plan, he said, okay, we're going to do it. And just doing it and just traveling a few times there to up morale is not really a scientific way of doing it and knowing what to do and what not to do. It was fast forward speed of conquering without plan. I mean, they had elections, I think, shortly after that, if I remember correctly. I mean, you don't just go in a nation, change them, and say, okay, Western civilization, electoral system, go ahead and vote.
Right.
You need to have a republic in place before you give them democracy. And that never happened. In Japan, that happened. They gave them a few years of building that republic before the democracy was introduced. Even in Germany, I think it took a long time before the parliamentary system took place, and it wasn't over, nothing was overnight. I mean, we had the Western and Eastern Germany as an aftermath of that, and it took years and years and years before Germany was able to be put together. And I think this is also going to take a long time. And it's important to us to just be careful, whatever happens, as far as our party is concerned and our advices are going out in public, and this is our position. We just have to acknowledge this is a big mess, that none of the other two parties know what they're doing. They got us into this mess. And we want to have a scientific eye on it, obviously, having in mind that this whole budgetary thing needs to go back to Bill Clinton's time.
Well, and I think to that point, there's what's really interesting about that is, people want to be led by an alpha type leader, right? So, and you always like whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, they don't have any idea what they're doing, but at least they get up there and say, "Oh, I know what I'm doing. I know how to fix the problem," and they throw out whatever they want, and it's total garbage, but it sounds good and they look like an alpha, so people want to follow it. Then you have the libertarians who, you ask them, "Well, how do you solve this problem?" And the libertarians will look you straight in the eye and say, "We don't know. Nobody knows because we don't have the right information. All I can tell you is that the other two idiots are completely wrong." And I think that to most people doesn't look like realistically. So, okay, so you've got three people to look at. One guy says he knows how to fix the problem. The next guy says he knows how to fix the problem. The third guy says he doesn't know how to fix the problem, but he thinks the other two guys are lying. Which one are you going to follow? And most people are going to follow the one or the two. And it's a psychological game, but that's kind of the reality of how, where people put their votes and their attention, which is extremely unfortunate, but that's human nature. There's not too
No,
much you can change there.
you're right. And also, I think our party, because of all the blackouts we've had since 20, really 11, that Gary Johnson joined, I mean, we saw how much the media and the polling companies and all of them ignore. So we don't even have a voice to debate these
Right.
topics. But thanks to Donald Trump and his beloved administration, who are just dropping off the wall like a fly every day, there is not going to be a Republican Party in the not so long distant future. So given this opportunity and given that our party is growing, I think us focusing more on debating at least foreign policy and figuring out what's what in more detail would give the public more of a view that, hey, yes, we don't know what the solutions in detail would be to get out of this mess, but we want to have a debate about it because the other two are not having it. The media organizations are not even broadcasting what goes on a daily basis. I mean, it's funny. You have our military budget gone so many trillions of dollars, and then the media attention on foreign affairs is going down. If you look at it, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But
so
I think that's something.
What's interesting, and so this is kind of my approach to foreign policy. For anybody who doesn't know, I'm running for, well, sorry, I can't tell you I'm running for president in 2020, but I can't tell you I'm not. My entire approach to foreign policy there is to say, you know, world peace. That's the destination. We're going to get there. Because the reality is, you know, for one, that's something that we can say where, you know, first of all, we're not a bunch of cowards who don't know what we're doing. We know what we want. We know how to get there. You know, yeah, sure, we can tweak the little details of exactly what that path looks like. But, you know, just like Trump's wall, you know, it was, you know, oh, we're going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. He had no plan for that. He had no strategy in place. There's no way he could make them pay for it. He had no idea how much it was going to cost. Like all of these things, he didn't even know that it's not even going to solve any of the problem that he claimed it was going to solve. But it was a definite goal that he set, which is we're going to build this wall. And in that way, I'm saying we're going to get to world peace, and we can. And you know, that's I think a more realistic goal than Trump's wall. If you look at it with the perspective of at least we're setting the goal instead of, because what do most libertarians say the goal is? Oh, we need to stop fighting with this particular country or this particular country. That's not really so much a finite goal than to say we just need to be at peace with everybody. I think that's more of a finite goal, because if you say, oh, we're going to stop fighting with this country. Oh, well, what happens if they fight back with us? Okay, well, I guess we need to defend ourselves, and that starts bringing up more military action and everything else. But if you say the goal is going to be world peace, well, then whatever happens, we need to react in a way that's going to bring us closer to that goal. And so whatever possible situation you can throw, hypothetical that you can throw at me, that's going to be the answer. Whatever takes us closer to that goal. And that's you know, that's the Trump's wall approach. That's, you know, it's the definitive, decisive, this is what we have to do. Otherwise, we're just going to be fighting forever. If we don't make a decision now to stop it, it's just going to continue on forever.
I agree with you. I mean, most of even our budgetary deficit, which is add up to $21, $22 trillion right now, really peaked after 9/11.
Yep.
So there was, before 9/11, we had surplus under Clinton. Now, taxes were high. There was a lot of arguments that libertarians can have against the system of taxation. But
it was a surplus.
The country had logical approach to foreign policy. Whereas since then, there's not a plan for stability. There's not a plan for world peace that we keep hearing. Said, so this guy's that guy's that in media. And
yeah,
you look at what we're doing is drones, bombs, budgets going up. If
right.
drones were more efficient, why are we spending more money on them?
I mean,
something as a whole is wrong.
The reality is you've got, you know, war is more attractive and fear is more attractive as counterintuitive as that sounds. People are attracted to fear. When they see a message of peace on one TV and a message of fear on the other TV, they're going to stare at the fear because they're going to be like, oh my God, we need to do something. Oh my God, I'm afraid. Like, what are we going to do about this? And so that's why people are attracted to the, you know, like the warmonger presidents, the warmonger representatives, you know, whoever it is, they're attracted to that because these people, and they might not be making it up. Maybe in their head, they actually believe that there are these great irrational fears out there that everyone else should be afraid of. But it's the Chicken Little story, you know, one person gets legitimately afraid and then they start spreading panic to everybody else. And now all of a sudden you've got an entire country who's supporting somebody who wants to go to war because of an irrational, unfounded fear that they developed somewhere.
Yeah. And that's not only observed in this war instance, but in our elections, really the Western hemisphere. If you look at, even Sweden, who had an election just a few days ago, you see the extremists, the far extreme left and right, are gaining more power, more votes, and that's out of fear. So what with Brexit? None of the politicians who want Brexit wanted that policy to win because there was no end goal. It's just like, just get up. And then on I remember Brexit night, all of these politicians are on TV and they're like, their faces are not happy. They're not smiling, and they're thinking, oh, now we need to plan. What are we going to do after this? So kind of like in the U.S. too with Donald Trump. I mean, these are all based on fear. Everything has been, and you're right, and fear is everything that's really in the past 5 or 6 years is dominating. Where our voters are going to go, like Bernie Sanders' crowd is out of fear on the left. Fear of the Bezos Act was just a few days ago. And all the ultra-rights are obviously fear of immigrants. This guy looks like that. That girl looks like that. So they don't look like us.
They're going to kill us. They're going to take stuff away from us. They're going to, you know, they're going to bring drugs. They're going to change our culture. They're going to change the way of life that we're used to. Yeah, it's endless. And half of those things could be looked at, you know, in a positive light. It's really... Sorry, my dog's over here going crazy. It's you know, you can spin things. You can take anything really and spin it. Like you can say, you know, the Mexicans are gonna come across the border and they're gonna change our way of life and change our culture and everyone's gonna have to learn to speak Spanish. Or you could look at it and say, oh yeah, we're gonna be more multicultural. We're gonna have the world's gonna be more colorful because there's gonna be more people bringing different types of art and food and everything else from different places of the world. It's the same thing that's going on, which is immigration of people, and it's how you react.
And again, you have people from other states who have no idea about the border states, like Texas and New Mexico and California, who are talking against immigration. I mean, Donald Trump and his whole group. I mean, in Texas, half of our population are Hispanic. Now they're not all from Mexico, but they're Hispanic. They have ties to Spanish language and culture. Yeah, obviously different cultures, but. So it's, again, people without knowledge and without any roots in what they perceive to be a problem are talking about a problem that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Same with the foreign policy. You have people that don't know about it in power, and then they say, okay, A, B, C, D, let's do it. It's a machine.
Yeah, put a spin on it so you can sell it.
Exactly. And then the media, obviously... picks up on it.
Well, they sell whatever they can to get ratings and advertisers and sponsors. So yeah, it all works together so perfectly. Yeah. Man, anyway, okay. So look, I think we're at time for today. But this has been interesting and we should definitely do this again sometime.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed it.
You have any websites you want to plug while you're here?
As far as websites go, there's a page that I'm part of called Liberty First, formerly known as, what's it called? Republicans for Gary Johnson. There's also another page called Republicans for Gary Johnson for Senate, that if viewers would like to go and look into. The whole idea of Republicans for Gary Johnson and in the future for whoever's maybe running in our ticket as a former Republican would be the idea that libertarians have understood that there is a lot of Republicans out there who don't have a home to go to anymore after the Trump. And we are the closest to the original conservative idea of fiscal conservatism, and in social areas, just government out of it. And the hope is that we would have this opening message, an open debate message, that we're really a party of debate and a party of reason and sanity more than anything else. And we welcome all the refugees, not only from the Republican side, but also all the moderates in the Democratic side who want to join us and be part of this libertarian movement. So those are a few pages.
Definitely. Yeah. So, yeah, we definitely need to, I mean, that's a really good point. We need to discuss ideas, because a lot of people I see in the Libertarian Party now are, I have my ideas and I just need to convince everybody else, and this is what we're going to do. And there's, I guess discussion is rare. And it should be more open, and we should talk about that. And
yeah, I think one of the things that I'm guilty of to some extent, also, we have discussion and debates more on individuals and personalities. If it's more on issues like you and I are doing and dealing with, you're wearing taxation is theft theme. Great marketing, by the way.
Thank you.
Not something I would have done. But we're debating issues. We're debating ideas. This is really something that, as you mentioned about the factor of fear, once the outsiders look at us and they see we're actually people who are discussing issues more than the R's and the D's, that would be something that they might decide, hey, we're middle class America. The Republicans have left us. Let's join the Libertarians and help them build it on these noble principles.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't want to get into it now, because that's a whole other topic for another day. But we'll talk about that some other time. Anyway, Reza, it's been great talking with you. And
great talking with you, Dan, as well.
Taxation is theft.
All right. Good evening.